Semi-crazy, I think that's less than most. My delusions aren't quite up to snuff. I see the news, a rag soiled with lies. It only gets love when somebody's died. See the cars zip past the crosswalks. Watch you hurry, a wander to the sky. Boring job, one that's gonna kill ya. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
When last we left our incredulous philosophers, they had been sealed inside the think tank doing battle with the existential crisis.
You there, janitor, get back to cleaning. What do I pay you for?
You don't pay me, Professor.
Well, if you'd like to keep it that way, you should get back to work.
Will I ever draw a salary? Will I ever see my wife and children again? These questions and more...
Silence! And welcome, one and all, to Professor Metal's irate debate and calamitous commentary with the Philosophical Chang Gang. Today's episode, part two of Art and Subsidization. Who's paying the piper? I'm your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm Bruce.
I'm River.
Philosophers, you may resume your toil.
We talked a lot before going into the think tank about positives associated with paying for the arts and having a thriving arts community. And we talked a little bit about the negatives of someone manipulating an arts community in a way that makes it less of an authentic gesture and more of something to benefit their particular worldview. But there have to be some negatives to having too much money in our community to begin with. The idea that you over-subsidize art must exist also if there is a correct amount of subsidization.
If you're putting over an abundance of money into an art community to help subsidize art, you kind of run into the problem where you oversaturate, for one, where you have so many people producing art that it starts maybe being not so good or not as profound as art would be otherwise. If you have people that are being paid to constantly pump out art, what their vision is sort of becomes diluted.
Although measuring the quantity of art is of somewhat, say, fluid subjectivity, regardless to how we compare quality of most other items, I think we can point to some examples where an oversaturated or a captive market for art does tend to bring the quality down. I'm thinking of, well, examples where the government is like paid television shows and movies to produce art with messages, like, you know, anti-drug messages and stuff like that. Most people would objectively reviewing those episodes would say that those are a lower quality. And it would make sense because the objective of the people making it is something other than to produce the best art they could.
Sure, and it seems like on some level art is a little bit of a trial and error, that you basically sort of cast the seeds out and see what comes back, and you know, sometimes you haul in some really great piece and sometimes you'll haul in some not so great stuff. So to that extent, I suppose seeding the water is beneficial in that there is more to catch and thus a better chance of catching the really good thing in the net. That said, though, there's a signal-to-noise ratio problem. If you have too few really good things and a lot of dross, basically, coming back out of the system, you have a problem with not getting noticed for the really good stuff, not being able to spread it as widely or make it as available.
One other example that comes to mind is Christian music. Modern Christian music that fundamentalist Christians listen to, they won't listen to anything else, tends to be kind of vapid, generally considered by most people not very good. But throughout the broader range of history, religion has famously inspired many great artworks. But when you've got that sort of captive market of a certain group of people who will only listen to things with these certain themes, then it doesn't have to be good, it just has to have those themes.
Oh, certainly, to the point where sometimes I personally have been exposed to something through a friend where it's like, wait, these guys are actually, you know, Christian rock group or Christian metal group or something, where the expectation is that they're good, therefore they're probably excluded from this subset of genres, and they end up being the exception.
Well, definitely our expectations play heavily into what we find in the world in this way. I mean, this is back to the idea of the artist who doesn't get discovered until after their death. You know, the expectations of the culture around us are often set to one particular mode of viewing things, and even though a piece may be great in its own right, it may not be the kind of piece that we were looking for at the time. And unless that catches on in advance, it may take some time for culture to come around to the point where it is prepared to appreciate properly that work.
And I think in those cases we slightly overcorrect as well. We think, well, we should have really appreciated them in their time more. So we're going to really make sure to... Everybody knows about this guy. And that's not just in the art world. I think that also applies to our book, Buckminster Fuller, Nikola Tesla.
In the art world itself, not just paintings. Of course, paintings are a big part of it, and sculpture and things like that. Van Gogh, of course, famously wasn't recognized for his work until years after his death. But that happens a lot in movies, too. A lot of people hold Citizen Kane in some of the highest accolades, as far as you can for a movie, but when it was released, though possibly due to some meddling on the part of a certain media mogul, it was not well received. It certainly didn't make back its production value, and it kind of ruined Orson Welles' career, although other political reasons at the time helped that along quite a bit, unfortunately. Brazil by Terry Gilliam is another great example. At the time, the Universal Studios, who was releasing it in the United States, was only willing to give out a severely edited cut of the movie that had a happy ending and was nice and cheerful, and the good guy got the girl, which is very different from the actual intent of the movie, which is much bleaker, I think.
I think that effect of something being underappreciated in its time, particularly with regards to film, is quite possibly could be a criteria for what gives us a cult classic.
I think there's some crossover with cult classics on that, but I don't think it's necessary. The example that I was thinking of when you were mentioning Brazil is Akira Kurosawa's films. While Kurosawa was certainly alive during the time when he was appreciated the most, his work was in the public for many years before he got any accolade, before he was treated as a serious director in most venues, and certainly in the West. But now he's considered one of the masters of filmmaking, bar none. He's right up there with some of the other great names. In terms of cult classics, though, I think of Eraserhead, for example, which certainly has cult classic status, but that came about on its own without needing to be unappreciated for a long period of time. It just was created before the fame of the director kicked in.
A lot of cult classics, without getting too much deeper into it, they became well recognized and certainly got some accolades very quickly, but not in the art critic crowd or the film critic crowd. El Topo, another great example. Jodorowsky is now considered a very progressive, very avant-garde director and still making movies, but the film critics weren't the first to pick up on him. It was a bunch of 20 and 30-somethings that were willing to turn out for a midnight screening at their local art house theater. El Topo is the cult classic movie, really. It is the first midnight movie.
Well, and there are certainly some instances of directors and films that have cult classic status that never achieved any particular fame outside of those circles. I'm thinking specifically of Lloyd Kaufman and the Toxic Avenger series. While a lot of people are aware of its existence, very few people actually sit down and watch these movies, and to the extent that even when he does a premiere of a new one, he still does it in a very small theater to a very small crowd, because people who are into his movies are well aware of what he's doing and what Troma Films as a production company is doing, but are not the wider audience of movies in general.
In most cases, with few exceptions, such as midnight movies taking off sort of in their own little viral way, The economics of movies, how movies get paid for, seems to be almost the most reasonable of the arts. There are studios who are trying to turn a profit, movies are judged by their box office sales, whether they succeed in that. It's run more the way you'd expect a business to be run, with proper profit margins and so forth, perhaps, than visual arts or other types of arts. One exception I would actually point out to this is, and this is something that Kevin Smith talks about, is the actual money that it takes to produce most movies isn't that much of its overall budget. You can make a movie that's pretty decent for $10 million, but in order to talk most people into seeing it, they've got to spend $30, $40, $50 million, and they decide whether to underspend on the advertising and promotion, in which case no one sees it, or very often they overspend it, in which case the director is held responsible if it doesn't make back that entirety, including the ad budget they added to it. So there is very much arbitrariness in the promotion of movies, but not so much the making of them.
To be fair, there is a reason that we have these defined sort of super genres of movies at this point, the sort of blockbuster movie, the summer movie, versus the art house flick. Like, you're not going to see Lars von Trier or Terrence Malick show up at your local Regal cinema. It just doesn't happen. Because of that, you end up with these super genres, where in, like, one category you have Michael Bay and J.J. Abrams, who are getting $100-200 million budgets. They don't use all of it, obviously, but they're given this gigantic budget to make a big, flashy, impressive movie, Michael Bay especially. Although he is kind of a crossover case in a weird way, and I'm not going to get too much into that. So you have these, like, directors that are well-known for making big, flashy movies, and then you have these directors that are held to kind of a different standard, where they're expected to be low-budget and very personal films, and very much the sort of starving artist ideal as applied to filmmakers, as it were.
And given studios can have different business models, whether they want to put, you know, all of their money into a blockbuster, or whether they want to spread it out a bunch of smaller films, there's a different risk-to-reward profile for each. They probably most studios would want to spread it along both, all of those. Some in the big ones, some in the small ones, and a little bit of money spread in between.
Well, I think a lot of that comes down to how we view what a movie is. I mean, there's always this tension between, is a movie entertainment or is a movie art? And it's not to say that there can't be any crossover between the two, but primarily the movies that we give the huge budgets and the flashy special effects to are considered entertainment for the most part. They're not expected to be particularly deep or moving, although they're allowed to have moments of depth and meaning, but they're expected to deliver a lot of enjoyment for the audience for that period of time. Whereas the lower budget movies that we expect to be very deep and meaningful and spend very little money are treated as art pieces.
I think that is the potential to change over time too, because how we perceive art as a culture does change over time. We've talked about that a little bit. German Expressionism is a great example of that. German Expressionist movies tended to be somewhat flashy for being primarily silent films, certainly all in black and white, but one of the most well-known Expressionist films was Metropolis, and that was a big blockbuster of its time. Also, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, also very heavy effects, very big movies, you know, for what we expect to be a rather more subdued period of time, and those are held today as being masterworks and being sort of the basis, because they ended up going on to influence film noir and so much of cinema after the fact.
That notion of art versus entertainment is a little bit problematic in a philosophical sense, because the more modern blockbusters, and later Spielberg through Michael Bay and all of these big movies, are very good at telling you how to feel. And one, I think, valid judgment of artistic merit is, how does it make you feel? And these blockbuster movies are very good at just hitting these specific beats of both musical and story cues, where you're supposed to feel uplifted here, you're supposed to feel excited here, worried here, now relieved. Now this beloved character is thought dead, we're supposed to feel sorrowful, we discover they're alive, we're relieved again. They're very good at just clearly directing the audience to feel a series of emotions.
I definitely understand that, as being from an artistic standpoint does kind of help you feel things, but I think a lot of the cynicism that comes up from against blockbusters is that it holds your, they hold your hand as they lead you down this path of emotions, as opposed to some of the more difficult, I guess, art pieces, or even not so difficult art pieces, again, like Brazil, where instead of having your hand held and being led down this path of now you feel happy, now you feel sad, you end up with this mixture of emotions, like, am I supposed to be happy? The ending of Brazil, the true ending, the one in which Sam Lowry completely succumbs to madness and retreats into his own head, certainly left me with a mix of emotions. Do I feel happy for Sam for having escaped this kind of hellish bureaucratic world that is Brazil, or do I feel sad for him that he had to do that? You kind of have to reconcile, I guess, those versus just being told, now you feel happy, now you feel sad, now you feel triumphant.
It's complex and nuanced, and it requires the audience member to directly engage with it and decide how to feel, as opposed to being told, this is how you will now feel.
The blockbusters are, they're trying to be art, and then they're trying to make you feel something, but in doing it in such a brute force way, once you see through it, you're just rolling your eyes for the whole time. In Jurassic World, as soon as they introduced the two stereotypical Spielberg children that I'm supposed to worry about, I was rooting for the dinosaurs to eat them.
That might just be because you're a terrible person. Speaking of terrible people, though, let's talk about some of the other effects that art can have on the world. Things that art has been associated with in the past that aren't necessarily such positive benefits to the community.
Certainly, art dealership has had a long and sort of storied history of having ties to criminal and underground organization. The fact that art is sold regularly between private individuals with little to no record kept of it, even though it has to be by law in most places, it still doesn't, because it's kind of hard to prove that it wasn't a gift or something like that. And so you run into this sort of legal questions that arise from that.
And it is an incredibly easy way to launder money, and it's a fairly open secret that this can be done because it has entirely arbitrary value. If a drug lord makes a finger painting, who's to say it isn't worth $5 million? And if someone gives him $5 million for it and he gives it to them, who's to say that that wasn't why they gave him the $5 million? He is, after all, a famous drug lord. Maybe his finger painting is worth a lot due to his infamy.
Well, certainly there have been figures who the art that they produced was valuable not because of what they did, but because of who they were. I'm thinking specifically of art that was produced by former President George W. Bush. Or perhaps in a more dubious case, the work of Adolf Hitler. And it's interesting how much the world of art intersects with World War II. When we look at paintings of dubious provenance, those things which have made their way from the families of Europe to museums that still have to constantly deal with questions of whether or not this was obtained legitimately, even if it was many hands ago, even if no one who would have stolen this piece is actually giving it to, loaning it to, or selling it to a museum, if that happened several buyers ago, it still has a dubious provenance and may become a legal problem to merely display.
Oh, certainly. I mean, recently there was a movie produced about this specific thing, The Girl with the Pearl Earring, I believe is the name title of the film, and it's about a person who was challenging a museum to get back a piece of art that belonged to her family, and the assistance she received from a lawyer, and kind of the big roadblocks that they came up against trying to retrieve this piece that had been pretty flagrantly taken, but like you said, several hands ago, and the fact that that chain of ownership can make things very murky.
Pieces with such a long and storied history, I think, are a little bit less interesting in the terms of how arbitrary the value of artwork is. I see this all the time with some modern artist paints something that looks like maybe a blank canvas. And it's selling for $1 million just to make a point of some sort. Almost as if the gatekeepers of the art world are just sort of trying to prove something to people who don't understand them. Like, oh yeah, take this.
So there was an interesting case that happened somewhat recently where an artist in New York, and I forget his name right now, but had basically gone to the Instagram accounts of Suicide Girls models and taken the selfies and general snapshots that they had produced on their Instagram and printed them on canvas and was selling them for $90,000 a piece. This is not technically illegal because they don't actually hold a copyright on those images. Because of the way that Instagram works and you're publishing through them, technically someone can go in and take it without too much trouble. You could probably make a case that he had no special right to use the images in that way, but rather than go into a legal battle over this, the Suicide Girls organization decided to respond by selling the same pictures printed on canvas for $90 a piece. Which I thought was a very clever way to counteract that.
Oh, certainly, and to kind of take a bigger take that at the artist that was selling them for $90,000, I believe all of the proceeds made from that were given to charity, just to make him look like an even bigger tool. Just as a point of clarification, I believe the pieces that were printed on canvas weren't just the pictures, but the picture and the frame around it, it was a screen cap from Instagram, to kind of prove that he had taken them from Instagram, because if he had taken them from the Suicide Girls site, that is copywritten, and that could cause a large legal battle.
This is arbitrary value of art squared. An artist took a hard drive, and he downloaded a bunch of pirated movies and music onto it, sort of painted it gold and put it in Lucite, and he was going to sell it for... He calculated what the RAA and MPAA say that the value of a download of those movies and music are, and it came to something like, I think, $30 million. Ridiculous total for, you know, some movies and some music. And so that's what he set as his price tag to sell that as.
Sure.
I don't believe he sold it, because it's, you know, the equivalent of what, well, a lot of us probably have on our hard drives.
That is kind of an interesting, that you're kind of bringing up, is the associated value of music and movies, as at least according to the regulatory agencies that kind of control their value, the recording, at least in America,
are given the legal right to state their value, what the value is. The process seems to be there is a person who is assigned the legal right to state what the value of a piece of art is, usually the maker, and that person names a number, and that number is considered the value of the art. Might or might sell, but for legal purposes, it's still considered the value of it. In terms of turning money into transferable things, this is completely open-ended.
What I was kind of getting at was sort of to talk a little bit about the arbitrary nature of what something's worth, especially in the artistic community. At one point, RIA, the Recording Industry Association of America, puts a price tag basically on what a person should be charged if they're found with pirated material on their computer. And at one point they levied a lawsuit against LimeWire, a rather popular tool for quote-unquote piracy at the time, for the total value of all files served through their servers. The judge ended up throwing it out after it was calculated that the total value they were asking for was more money than was available combined of all countries' GDP on Earth.
More money than actually existed, yes. Yeah,
exactly, more money than actually exists. And I definitely think that points a great deal to sort of the arbitrary nature of art prices.
So if we're going to talk about arbitrary values and art prices and their relationship to real money, I think we have to talk about the several artists who have taken it upon themselves to print their own money at one point or another. I would like to start with Banksy and his many, many pictures of the Queen on bits of paper that had his face instead of the Queen's.
There's been some interesting cases of artists producing their own money, and sometimes there are legal troubles, because that is a crime in many places. But sometimes they're a little more clever about it and kind of get around it, as it were. Another great example is the Emperor Norton I of San Francisco, the Emperor of the United States of America, man proclaiming himself the first rightful Emperor of the United States of America and disbanding Congress and something like and things like that, printed his own money, which isn't all that weird when you take into account the rest of his story. But what is kind of interesting is the fact that businesses all around San Francisco started accepting it for a while he was still alive, and a period after he had died. You could exchange money for these notes. What he claimed was the now defunct United States currency for these notes, and then use them for goods and services at San Francisco. And it proceeded to be a currency. I can't remember the final fate of it. I don't know if the U.S. Treasury Department ever stepped in or not. I don't know that ever was a big enough problem for them. But it was kind of, for a time, they just kind of used a different currency.
I'd be passing interested to see what a Norton dollar would be worth today.
Quite a great deal, because they are considered a relic at this point. A historical artifact, as it would.
There's another artist whose name escapes me, who does lithograph art. He engraves plates, he prints, and he does things that look a lot like money, but they have different designs, original designs, and they're really high quality. He's very much in demand by the art world, but he sort of plays this game where he'll go to a diner, and he'll go, "I'd like to trade you a meal for this piece of artwork that I made. It's not money, I just want to trade you it." And they might say yes, or they might say no. If they say yes, he gives them the meal, he gives them the piece of artwork. And very often, after he leaves, what'll happen is an art dealer will come in behind him and say, "Did he trade you one of his money-like artwork pieces? Because I'll give you $10,000 for it right now." Because that is the only way that his art pieces get into circulation. He doesn't sell to the dealers directly. He tries to get people to trade him goods and services for it. And they follow him around, buying them up behind him.
So one of the famous examples of this was that Picasso was known to oftentimes pay his bill at a restaurant or something similar by just pulling out a little satchel of colored pencils that he carried with him, and he would doodle on the check and leave it behind. In a very famous instance of this, one waiter tried to chase him down the streets of Paris in an attempt to get the money for his meal, not realizing who it had been sitting there, and not understanding how he was supposed to accept a tracing of the fish bones from his meal as payment. So we're talking a lot about physical art, the art that we're more familiar with from history, and we've touched a little bit on digital art. But let's talk a little bit about specifically how the digital revolution has affected the art world. In what ways has the transfer from physical media to digital media affected the ability to create art or its value?
For one thing, copying becomes negligible in cost. So people actually have to start considering not so much the value of the thing, but the value of appreciation, I think, and support.
Definitely. I mean, that's a lot of online artists, purely digital artists, that do little to no actual physical artwork, tend to work on specifically commissions or through one of several services, the most popular of which being Patreon, a sort of modern digital form of patronage that's crowdsourced, as opposed to having like a Medici family where you have one small group of people paying a great deal of money. You have a large group of people paying a little bit each, and that way this artist can do what they enjoy, producing the art that these people like, and still make a living off of it.
For those of you interested in finding out more about Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/philosophy.
Okay, so yeah, Patreon's a good crowdfunding kind of way to distribute the cost of things out. It's based on what somebody feels like giving an artist for the work that they're producing. And it's a really good way to fund small projects. It's much better than a lot of the alternates like grants or, you know, large endowments, fellowships, those kind of options. Because if you draw 30 My Little Pony fan arts once a month and then stop, it's not necessarily a good fit for you to go into residency at a hermitage of some sort and make sure that you have lots of time and are taken care of while you produce that important work. That said, it's not nothing, and if somebody's enjoying it, then there should be room in the system to support it. That said, though, there are a lot of formats that you couldn't go into Hermitage for. There are a lot of things that have come about as part of the digital revolution that are not fit with the normal means of making art that we're familiar with.
Oh, certainly, and a lot of it comes from the medium itself. Digital video, digital imaging, the GIFs as a piece of art, as it were, a GIF being, for those listeners who aren't familiar, a motion image, basically. Not quite a video.
Oh, do you mean a GIF?
Oh, you're talking about movies. I've heard of those.
Oh, you're talking about GIF.
Yes, that. Anyway, there is a new style of art that has come about with both digital video and GIFs, or GIFs, or JIFs, GIFs, depending on who you listen to, that is called data moshing, that uses inherent flaws and errors in those processes to create a new form of art, or entertainment, or whatever you would like to call it, by forcing these, what's called artifacting, where certain pixels don't quite mesh right. You end up taking a GIF that is previously established, maybe made by someone else, and messing with the code so that if you have someone falling down, it looks like they're constantly falling into themselves, or you have a thing where a person slides over from left frame to right frame and keeps going much farther than they should, and kind of messes with the medium effectively, and is I think both a good representation of what you can do in digital art that you can't necessarily do in the more conventional arts, but also a good example of remix culture, where you take a already established piece of art or something and make art out of it.
Well, it also fits into a larger framework, if you will, of what's called glitch art. That is basically the exoneration or an exaltation of the mistakes, the artifacts, the leftovers, the broken parts of it. And a lot of times this has to do with pixel art and things that look like they're from the 8-bit and VHS era, but have broken parts to them that create the artwork themselves.
Oh, certainly. I mean, there's type of artifacting in specifically known to VHSs in magnetic tape called tearing that isn't really a thing in digital production but is often used in digital production as an effect to kind of, again, mess with the, I guess, viewer's perception of what's going on in frame.
I'm trying to think if there's an equivalent in physical media where maybe it used flaws or errors in the physical media itself, maybe the grains of the canvas, or maybe wood grains or something. I'm having a hard time coming up with any good examples.
I think there's a little bit of an example in sculpting. When we look at some of the great sculptors of the past have talked about the notion that a piece of marble or stone or whatever they're carving in sort of has to speak to them in a particular way. It has to have a particular image already inside of it for them to bring it out. And to some degree, that's a master craftsman's understanding of the flaws in a piece of stone or wood or whatever else. That you have to understand that that knot is going to twist in this way in a piece of wood, and you're going to have to carve around it. And so that might not be appropriate for a lot of images, but it might be exactly the right curve for the, you know, the distended stomach of the pregnant Virgin Mary or something like that. Mm. That, I think, is a little bit of the same thing, but I think that to a large extent this takes and exonerates just the raw incorrectness and says, this isn't a mistake, this is a thing to be held up on its own.
Happy little tree.
Exactly.
But you know, with remix culture, glitch culture, mashup culture, sampling, an interesting thing about it, in much the same way that Patreon, Kickstarter, other things crowdsourced the appreciator, crowdsourced the patronage, the people who are paying, this sort of crowdsources the artist process itself. It spreads it out. I've made this. What can you do with what I've made? Do you have a new idea to add to it or to change it? And then to someone else, and it sort of spreads out from there.
I definitely agree that it kind of helps push out the concept of who the creator is, but I don't think that's a new concept. If you go back into before we had digital culture and glitch culture and things like that, you still had methods artists would use in which they almost crowdsource a piece of art. The most well-known example I can think of is the concept of the exquisite corpse, which is a type of art piece that is done where a piece of paper is folded in a specific way, and then an artist draws on one of those folds, and then it's passed to another artist, and they draw on another one, and so on and so forth, and they each get their own little piece of paper in which to do an art, and then the whole thing is unfolded, and the piece of art is all of those little things put together, even though that may not make much sense altogether. It does, if you look at it in the small scale, the large scale kind of becomes this jumble, but it is a piece of art that was created by several different people. Another example I kind of wanted to bring up was the use of paintings as somewhat inspiration for other paintings in classic art. Isaac Israels is a good example. A very early fan of Van Gogh's work ended up using several different variations of his Sunflower series as background for his own paintings, as well as Paul Gauguin's The Painter of Sunflowers, which was a portrait of Van Gogh painting his famous Sunflower series.
But let's be clear about the first example you were giving. You're not saying that he copied the picture into the background. You mean he actually used the picture itself?
No, he did copy it. Oh. There was another artist, whose name escapes me at the moment, unfortunately, who had purchased a piece of the Sunflower series, took it off of its frame, and stretched the canvas over a larger frame. He was considered very avant-garde, a French artist. Unfortunately, I cannot remember his name, but he stretched it over this canvas over a larger frame and then proceeded to paint in the cracks, basically. Paint in where the paint had broken on the now stretched canvas. And if that happened now, it would be considered nigh on artistic sacrilege or usury.
But back not then, to Van Gogh, but it does happen that there are people who they'll go to garage sales and they'll buy up old paintings that aren't considered worth very much. Some kind of a landscape, picture, and they'll paint something else over it. Very often, sometimes humorous, and makes it more interesting. That's a current movement.
Oh, definitely. I think while it may not have a direct connection, kind of has a similar roots in that, in the pseudo remix culture that happened when artists interacted with each other in classical art, where they would crib or kind of derive other artists' works in their own style.
Well, more broadly, from techniques of combining the works of two artists, there's just the notion of a thriving artistic community where they're constantly borrowing ideas from each other, sharing inspirations, techniques, and frankly, often flat out stealing. Any writers will tell you they do it all the time.
So we're talking ostensibly about art and the financing thereof, and remix culture and sampling and all of the associated ways in which there is some reuse of a previous piece causes a very interesting question to arise about the funding of art. Should art be considered new or transformative when somebody makes something out of someone else's art? Is the original artist to be paid for that, or is the new artist the rightful possessor of the art funding? And to what extent does showing proper respect to what came before, what you used to make your piece, become an important part of the culture around the funding of art.
A derivative artwork may not even have a simple linear progeny of pieces that it uses. Once you throw a remix culture together, it can be almost impossible to untangle all the pieces of each other's pieces that they're all borrowing from one another.
There are governments and organizations that have tried to quantify that remix culture, that the use of other pieces in a new piece. Probably the most famous example is there was an artist in Germany to protest this, had made a song in which they sampled some 30,000 other pieces of work. It was a project that was done over the course of, I believe, a year, year and a half. And the way the law works in Germany is you have to fill out a form and basically pay a proportional amount of royalties to the original artist for any royalties made on that piece, on any new remixed piece. To protest this, he made this 30,000 song mashup, basically, and then showed up to the head offices of the company that deals with this in a flatbed truck with boxes and boxes of these forms that him and his friends had filled out, and caused quite a stir because it was kind of pointing to the unnecessariness or the pointlessness, I guess, of doing that, and kind of trying to point out that in some ways maybe the remix is a new piece of art whole cloth. Well, not necessarily whole cloth, but a new piece of art altogether.
The notion that we're starting to raise is a little bit is perhaps the difficulty of tracking who should be paid, how many of who should be paid, what portion of the proceeds from this, from everything that it borrowed from, and then that in turn might be paying a portion of that, can get extremely complicated. But then again, this is the information age. We have computers.
So one of the more interesting and old school versions of taking someone else's art to make your own is forgery. The creation of art that looks close enough that a non-expert couldn't tell the difference between the two pieces. Now, if the real value of a piece of art is in its appreciation, then it seems like the forgery is just as valuable as the original, and thus makes sense to be sold at the same price as the original. And yet, we have an inherent distrust of anything created in that way, especially when it's sold under false pretenses.
The false pretenses are the thing. We're being defrauded. But then again, with these great masters, these big, great paintings, the money that gets paid for it isn't going to the original artist, it's going to the owner, who bought it from someone. It prices it inflated far beyond what the original artist got, and that original artist is probably dead anyways. So, in the cases of a famous painting, who really cares who gets paid for it? It's not the artist.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said for the authenticity of the art. Original versus derivative works. And there are still plenty of people out there that scoff at remix culture or copy culture, that believe that if you take bits of a song and remix it and change it around so that you create something new out of it, maybe something that doesn't even sound particularly like the original piece, that is still less of a piece of art or a piece of music, even, than the original that you're taking it from. And I think that's part of it, is this sort of disconnect between the creators of remix culture and the people who are pushing back against it, saying it is less art than the original.
River, silence. Sean, I grant unto you the last word.
Gee, thanks, Professor. I think it'd be a good time to talk a little bit about funding projects that we think are important to the world. Trying to spend our money responsibly in a way that enriches both our lives as human beings and as intellectual beings. I think it would be a good time to talk about supporting the show through Patreon. It would be an excellent time for you to step up and help us make more of this show. Because quite frankly, if the professor don't get paid, we don't get to eat. And I like eating. I'm a big, big fan of eating. And it's very important to me that you go ahead and support us at patreon.com/philosophy. If you haven't done that yet, I just want you to imagine me starving to death slowly in front of you. That's how it feels when you don't support us at patreon.com/philosophy.
I think supporting the arts is really important. Really important. Especially to me, at patreon.com/philosophy. Am I getting the point through yet? Please help. So, arts funding is something that's very important to me. And very important to a lot of people that I know. It's an important part of our culture at large and an opportunity for us to all grow as individuals and develop a new set of experiences of the world that we might not have direct access to. And some of those experiences we should be very thankful that we don't have direct access to. I don't want to have an experience of the horrors of war, but I do want to have an experience of art created about the horrors of war. I want to be enriched as a person without having to have had the experiences of every other human being alive. And that ability to share what has gone on in us, to express the life experiences that have shaped us, and to weed out the parts that are less important and to focus on the parts that were truly meaningful, is a powerful ability that humans have. And using that ability, while it may not directly relate to a monetary gain, which in some cases art will, but in the vast majority of cases it doesn't, having that ability and using it in that way is still important, is still valuable. The tertiary benefits of education and experience of the arts are deeply important to developing more well-rounded individuals. It helps us to grow and expand beyond ourselves. It helps us to have empathy for others. It helps us to understand the point of view of people who, quite frankly, we may not want to listen to a lot of times. It helps us to understand differing ways of understanding the world. It helps us to become more than we have been in the past. And I don't think any humanistic endeavor could possibly have a more profound impact than that. It doesn't matter what the art is. Find the art that speaks to you. But the arts as a category need your support. They need you and me and everyone else to step up to that plate. And even though we may not be the wealthy patrons of the past, and even though we may not be able to create endowments that are able to fund many, many artists, each of us can help to make sure that we don't lose this essential part of what it means to be a human being from the experience of culture that we have. And I think that if we can take anything away from this, it's understanding that when we don't choose to fund ourselves, when we don't become a part of the process of seeing to it that funding is available for artists, we leave that decision up to someone else. And what they will choose to do with that is sort of out of our control. And that may be a very dangerous situation for us as a culture, as individuals, and people who are still trying to grow and understand more about the world around us. To that end, I hope that you will go to patreon.com/philosophy and support our show, because I think we're doing good work, and I think that we're trying to help expand how we all look at things. If you decide not to, maybe you could at least hit the share button. That'd be cool, too.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Don't forget to subscribe and review on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, send us your questions, and if you like what we're doing, support us on Patreon. Join us next time after I make the janitor decide which of his children he wants back the most. I've been your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm Bruce.
And I'm River. Say, that announcer had a really great voice.
Yeah, I don't know why the professor doesn't use him to announce more.
I try not to question Professor Metal. His assassin mimes are silent but deadly. Secure.